Hello, listeners, and welcome to the David Krutt podcast. Today, we'll be bringing you a conversation between David Krutt and Ernest Seemark, a bat conservationist and the director of the African Bats non-profit organization here in South Africa.
Ernest, you must be wondering what you're doing in a bookstore and art gallery talking about your life work, which is around bats. But it's our belief that visual arts are just one of the great ways of informing people and using one of the most important faculty they have, sight. But there's so much more in terms of creatives in other areas, scientists, even bankers who could contribute a lot more to the world if they understood creativity. But what you do is so important in understanding the environment. And so I've invited you to come and give us a sort of Bats 101, and hopefully this will be a place that you can continue to use as a platform or a base for when you want to inform people about what you do.
Thank you, David. No, it's a great opportunity. I think a lot of disciplines need to cross. As I come from more of a hard science background, we are aware that there is creativity. Our history has shown us that there's major influences, and the more creativity that there is out there, the more advances that can be actually be made. Obviously, my passion or an interest has been in bats. That occurred many, many years ago as a student, and that interest was actually driven purely because we knew very little or know very little about these unknown little animals that are about one-fifth of all the mammal species in the world. And bats themselves are quite unique in the ecosystem. They're one of the only mammal groups that utilize the night. If you think about the number of birds that you see during the day, but if you look at around the world, there's very few birds that utilize the night. Bats are part of the mammals. They give birth to live young. They have fur. They can regulate their own body temperature. So they're not like the reptiles. But people did believe even 10 years ago that birds and mammals started to dominate the world about 65 million years ago with the extinction of the dinosaurs. But as science changes and with the fossils that were found in China of the feathered dinosaurs, they started to realize that the birds are actually much, much older than mammals. So birds themselves are almost 180 million years ago started coming off the dinosaurs because they're actually much more closely related to reptiles, as in birds also have eggs, reptiles lay eggs. So yeah, the 65 million years ago is basically when the extinction of the dinosaurs with the comet meteorite hitting the Earth is the dominant hypothesis at this point in time that caused a mass extinction event. And more than likely, that was also a point in time where birds also had to compete. And in that period of time before the comet, there was obviously birds dominated during the day, and the birds themselves drove a lot of the insects into the night. So there was this whole new niche, so this whole new area of insects that were now utilizing nighttime activities. And that's where bats themselves started to come into their own. And they were able to evolve from that period with all the other mammals. All mammals would have irradiated at about that 65 million years ago, give or take. And they definitely came from something that was gliding. Slowly, they're the only mammal that has the ability of true flight. And from the insect perspective, is most of the bats are insect eaters around the world. And at the same time, there's quite a lot of plants that have also seemed to have also started to be evolved and be pollinated by bats. So some of the wild bananas in Pacific and Indonesia, places like that, are linked with pollination of certain bat species. So the fascination was specifically how in Africa, was also to realize what we think we know, and then suddenly realizing that what we think we know is not always the same. So it's always exciting to think you know something and then get proven wrong. And I think that's the nature of science itself, is always when we know that, not wrong, but sometimes as new information comes in, is to keep changing perceptions.
Yeah, the amplification of knowledge is very, very exciting.
Yeah.
For those of us who are sort of knowledge addicts, wanting to know how this thing evolves, how it works and all that. So I think you can easily get hooked onto something as large as what you're talking about. That's going back 65 million. One wonders about insects before 65 million, because if there were bats before the extinction of the poor dinosaurs, there must have been insects. And has anybody ever studied that arena? Just as an aside.
The insects go back, even way further back than 180 million years. Because 180 million years ago is when the reptiles and that started dominating. And so insects go back even further than that. So even within the fossil records, you'll actually find in all the rock formation dragonflies that are almost the size of us as well. So some of these huge insects, I mean, I wouldn't want to be living around at that point in time. I think we'd be the prey items. And it's that changing of ideas. And I think also for me, and I know with sort of the students that we're trying to teach, is also to read some of the older scientific papers, but understand the knowledge or the concept that we're having. So Charles Darwin himself, when he left and around, he was still animal, vegetable, mineral. That's his classification system. And that was developed by the early Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish botanist who started coming up with a scientific naming system. We go back to Aristotle, and that was ice, stone, very similar concepts. We've moved very much away from the ideas of animal, vegetable, mineral, and that has definitely broken up. And I will admit, when I was at school, even the different kingdoms were very much, was just like the animalia, plants, and like fungi. Actually, fungi were part of plants, but now there's like 8 or 9 different families. And it's something that we have to also understand. And even now, moving into the microscopic world, we have bacteria and viruses, like we're talking about, like COVID. Those are not alive because they're actually not self-replicating. So they're a bit of a question mark on the whole system, but they are very important in the ecosystem that we are actually dealing with. So I guess, as you're saying, is bats are an interest, but it's to actually understand that whole system that's out there. I guess what is being taught today, I'd love to be around in 50 years time to see what is going to happen to our textbook. Because I think most of what we think we know and what we're teaching now is going to be seriously changing.
And I suppose, isn't it, it's also like the mystery of the brain. I'm sure as the brain gets more and more expansive with all this, people will be able to deal with this new intensity of knowledge.
Yeah, I think the knowledge themselves is something that is coming out in the research, specifically within bats. And a lot of research has been put into bats. I mean, US agriculture put in a couple of years ago over $6 billion into bat research. And that's purely because of a fungus that is decimating the US populations of bats. They're having 95% to 99% death rates. Their bats have been wiped out from a fungus that is found in caves in Europe, which the bats there seem to be fine having this fungus. As we, in the early days of the corona outbreak, we used to watch our maps of how it was spreading and how quickly it spread. They trying to map this. And this is a fungus that gets onto the wings of the bats. And during winter, which is a critical time, there's no food available, the bats can go into what is hibernation. They can drop their temperature below that of 0 degrees. Their hearts are pumping like one every 16 seconds or so. You would almost think that they're dead. And those bats themselves have, obviously the US agriculture coming into it was their money. Farmers now have to pay for pesticides. And that's real money. It's not hypothetical or anything, and they try to find solutions. Luckily, it seems to be in the colder parts of the country. The drier parts of the country, luckily, it hasn't spread to, because the bats there are, well, they don't necessarily get to those cold temperatures. But with the bats themselves is also with diseases, a lot of diseases. Bats have been put in, they've been on to test, and they find antibody. Did you, by any chance, contract COVID?
Fortunately not.
No, okay, you're fortunate. But have you had a vaccine?
Yes.
So what would happen if I had to take a blood test from you now? It would show antibodies for COVID because you have been exposed to the vaccine. And so a lot of bats have been put into a bit of bad light by finding it, in that a lot of diseases have been found. But the disease is not necessarily a live disease. It's based on antibody tests. So they've been contracted with it and have been found to shed this. And past research has been that because bats are flying mammals and flight takes up a lot of energy, their body temperatures are generally much higher than what a normal human would be. And therefore, if you get a cold or a flu, how does your body respond?
You get a temperature.
Okay, so your body goes up to that temperature, and obviously with small children, you're very concerned about this. Bats, when they're flying around, it's like, imagine you sprinting everywhere, from everywhere you go, just run. Your body temperature will be high. And yes, it will kill off most of these diseases because they don't definitely like that environment. And that's why they've been worried and they've been concerned, because if a virus or a disease can be survived by a bat, if that gets into a human, we don't have necessarily the natural defenses for it. And that has now also been changed now with some genetics, where again, with lovely COVID, suddenly there's all money and trying to link it back. They've been able to find that within the bats have got quite a unique ability, that they've got an ability to repair DNA. With us as humans, as our DNA gets older, it starts to unravel, and part of the aging process. But bats have an ability to actually survive and actually repair. Their DNA actually repairs. So there's some mines that are radioactive, and that you, as a human, you don't go in there without proper suits, or don't go in at all. And bats are living quite happily, and they don't seem to have deformities because they have this ability to repair DNA. And that ability is where now the research is coming through, is this idea of getting viruses and diseases, is they're able to combat those diseases quite efficiently. So bats in the future, the research front on medication, longevity, I know that there's a lab in, I think it's in Ireland or it's in Scotland, they're specifically pushing the idea of trying to do longevity. I hope people also put sterilization involved in that, people living for 200-300 years.
All coming from bats. But what's the normal average life of a bat if it's not attacked or whatever?
So the oldest record that they've gotten, that comes from Europe, is about 48 years old. In South Africa, a sister species of it, we know at least up to 18 years. And this is from banding type data. So for such a small animal, because it's such a good look at it, they have a much longer lifespan than, let's say, a rodent or shrew of similar size. I mean, when we're talking about something, we're talking about 8 grams compared to most of it. So they do seem to have a relatively longer lifespan. And you're talking about the threats to the bats themselves. Naturally, there's actually very few predators. There's the bat hawk that specializes, but again, it's only at dusk. We are aware of some of the barn owls at certain roost sites. So where a large stream of bats might be coming out, they'll try and capture. In Uganda, for instance, there's known as Python Cave, and you can imagine why they're there. There's these two big pythons that I don't think they go anywhere because their food is readily available. They just lift their head up and literally take a bat.
Is that an urban legend, or they're two pythons who are gorging themselves away in a cave in Uganda?
Yep, at Lerner's Python Cave.
It's important for people to think about things in a positive light, and bats immediately are thought of in a negative light. And when you touch on something like the DNA issue, that they're able to repair the DNA, they obviously are way beyond what humans can do. And when you think of a life period of 48 years. But let's come back to South Africa. Were there ever any recorded knowledge about big bat populations? Maybe they were also obliterated through disease. And how do they really fit into the South African environment?
Well, within South Africa, unfortunately, we don't really have much records. And that's the question they're saying, like in Europe or North America, the bat populations are decreasing. At this point, we actually have no baseline. We have from the non-necessary scientist side. Only from the 1960s did bats start to come more from an ecology. Most of the time, the bats were just collected as objects. So Dr. Andrew Smith, in the early 1800s, for instance, he, on his collecting trips, visiting around the country, he did a trip, for instance, from Cape Town to meet with Dingaan, Shaka's brother, since the film Shaka's out at the moment. And on his trip coming up, he collected through the old Transkei, Eastern Cape, and Natal, he collected a couple of bats along the way. And those are more than likely shot out of the sky.
Oh, really?
You
shoot them with a gunshot, right?
Yeah, we have had, that's the difference. More than likely with dust or with a shotgun. Those were the old methods. Our methods now, at least we can use nets, and there are certain types of traps, or if you know where caves are, we can go in there with a hand net and obviously capture some of these species. And those were some of the early, at least in South Africa, we're starting from the late 1700s, a few bats were picked up, but mainly from Cape Town, because that was the place. And then slowly, different people got to like Durban. So Birchall's, as in Birchall's, he was a Swedish biologist, collector. A lot of the people were collecting and they used to sell. And yeah, then slowly over the periods of time, I think more of the conservation research trying to understand bats came together. So it was really only in the 1960s, a German caver actually came across with some of the first bat bands, and via the caving community, so non-scientists, they started to actually ring bands, bats, and that's where our knowledge on suddenly the movement of some of the bats, and some of the cave bats at least, we do have some historical information that is from the caving community, which have been fortunate that we've been able to share their knowledge on what was available. And we are aware of certain caves that there were recorded of largish bat numbers. How many, we don't know. But we are aware that those caves were also blown up. A lot of caves were mined specifically for the stalactites and mites, especially for the development of Joburg, for cement, early cement works. And also it was used in the processing of gold. So I know within the Cradle of Humankind, for instance, a lot of the cave sites that were there, that they have been unfortunately blasted. I mean, even stack-contained caves have lost a lot of those mineral deposits. So there would have been an impact, and obviously bats moving to different areas. The tree-dwelling species of bats, to be honest, they are an unknown factor. In the UK, they have specific people that are involved in counting bats live in the trees. But I mean, if you go and look at their natural forest, less than Joburg size. The bats that we're currently working on, the Natal long-fingered bat, for instance, just the population in the savannah, covers the whole of the UK. We've got the bats moving from KwaZulu-Natal all the way up to northern Limpopo and moving all the way to caves near Kimberley.
So I read there were 56 different varieties of bats in South Africa, is that?
There's about 64 to 74, and that number is on the increase.
Oh, that's good.
The reason for that is obviously a lot more genetic work's being done and work, and a lot more species are actually being described. So a lot of material from South Africa, well, the wonderful world of politics has been around for hundreds of years. Most people will know Austin Roberts, the from the birding side. So in the early 1900s, at then was the Transvaal Museum, was the institution that was specifically established for natural history collections. And he started to obviously describe a lot of, at the time, subspecies or species. And species is also an artificial term. It's a human construct.
Yeah, I was wondering.
It's, for me personally, it's almost, we have a Judeo-Christian, as in God created these specific entities. But it's with bringing in the idea of evolution, change, these populations move apart, they get separated, things come back together again. We have also almost cultural or behavioral differences that will stop. And yeah, so there's this, over time, things are always in a state of change.
It sounds like bats actually could be a success story because they haven't been obliterated like so many other species have.
Yes, I think there are some species that are definitely at risk because they're very, very narrow niche or very, very restricted areas. And once you've lost those areas or those habitats, they don't have the ability. So you're looking at over in the world, there's over 4,000 and something species now. And I'm going to be quite honest with you, there's almost at least every month a new species being described. So it may have been from an old species, there was a whole bunch of things together, but as they start to investigate, they realize, no, that is different to something else. I mean, we've got a bat that is found just in southern Africa, and it's named after something that actually comes from Italy, Blasi's horseshoe bat, and the only reason is because it's actually got a very, almost like a rhino horn that has a very sharp point on its nose. Everybody's just said it's the same, but you've got this huge gap between here and Italy. How are they the same?
Yeah.
They call differently, they have different chromosomes, but it's the time and effort for a scientist to put a name onto something to say that this is different to something else. Australia, from a conservation perspective, they realized that some of these species of bats, they knew that they were different. If you put them together, you can see that they're different, but they were sharing the same name. And they actually, conservation-wise, started saying, this is species one, this is species two, this is species three, and this is what its description is like. And for years, they kept referring to these species one, species two, but everybody knew what they were talking about because the legislation. Because the naming of a species is something that is a little bit more difficult because people may have done beforehand something that is available. And a lot of that material is sitting in London or the US or in European museums. And what is known as a holotype. So a holotype is the object that the description actually comes from. And that's what you should be matching the name back to.
Right.
So a couple of years ago, quite a few years ago, I can't remember, I think France sold the kilogram. There were two actual things that's called the kilogram, and I think Canada or whatever purchased that object that is the measure of what a kilogram is. I'd love to know, after the kilogram of the 100-something years, has it actually kept its same? But it's the object that the name actually comes through from. And so you have to compare it back to it and try and measure. And with genetics coming into the picture, people have now been able to go back to this and match some genetics. I mean, 200 years ago, Africa itself could be anywhere. The Cape extended to northern Zambia.
Right, yeah.
It was that concept of, well, it's a Cape.
Just to come back to sort of the more simplistic things, can bats ever be a threat to any other species, humans, animals, and also the fact that there are fruit bats as well. So if bats seem to have survived, it seems a success story, whereas everywhere else in Africa, herds are reduced by 90%, animal herds. This seems to be an area which hasn't suffered, but is that a threat in any way that they could begin to destroy crops or bring disease possibly, which you touched?
So I think the question is at the species. I think a lot of people, a bat is a bat. And if you look at something flying out there, they all look alike. So these black objects, and people have fear of them. There are bats that have definitely become urban exploiters in the sense that they love buildings. The larger these populations come up, and this is where the bat house projects, so I definitely support those species. So putting bat boxes up specifically in protected areas or natural areas is actually putting threats on the naturally occurring species that are naturally already occurring there, because you're creating an urbanized environment. We don't quite support the bat box project here in South Africa. I know in North America and Europe, it's a big way of conservation of bats. But to put something into context, in the whole of the UK, there I think are 17 species. At the study site that I work at near Tabazimbi, just within a 100-meter, so 1 hectare plot of land, we've recorded 18 species, and there's potentially a couple of others that are flying around. So we've caught physically 18 different species in a 1 hectare
So that sounds like a success, whereas in Europe, all these species must have existed there. They've been obliterated, more or less. Here, there's still this huge number because there's no threat to them by, as you say, by predators.
I think the difference as well, and it seems in North America, and that is, what is the record before humans actually started establishing back then? I mean, bat research in America and in Europe is over 100 years old. They started to count and keep records. But as you get closer to the tropics, the numbers of bats definitely increase. And also the number of fruit bats start to go off the charts as well through that area. And that's going right across the world. So from the Brazil into Indonesia, they have a lot more fruit bats. Not that they actually have fruit bats in South America. They actually evolved fruit-eating bats, but they are actually not coming from the same common ancestor as in the old world. So new world versus old world, there definitely is a split. Something that we do look back at is, we do go back to that 65 million years ago. The world as we currently see it, from the old Gondwana land and concept, you think about that, is the continents were already very much as they are today. There's a bit more pushing up of India and aspects from it, but the spatial spread was around. And I know one of the groups of bats, they have done quite a lot of genetic research. Its origin actually comes from Indonesia, and it actually has recolonized the rest of the world.
Yeah, I suppose bats maybe could travel on ships, yes, and things like that.
Well, well, this was before ships.
Just by currents, air currents.
As we're moving across, something has changed. I mean, climate is something that is oscillating throughout the world, and changes happen.
Yeah. But to come back to what you're doing here, because you know, we're always wanting to provide a sort of a platform for people who've got a vision, and you're very much, I suppose, in the academic arena besides the scientific arena. How does one assist careers, you might say, in the bat world in South Africa? How does one familiarize people about bats and get them more interested? Could we create a movie like, you know, the Octopus My Teacher? But bats aren't that sort of appealing a way.
I think they're fascinating if you wanting to understand bats. The problem is at night, the types of cameras and that you would actually need. I mean, what a bat can do in a second, it can zip an insect, turn around and move around, and that's all done in 1 second. And I think that's where the technology we are limited by. I mean, even understanding the echolocation calls, as in the bats themselves are using, most of the bats are using sound. It's a pitch black night, as we would use a torch to navigate. The bats are actually using sound to create the actual ability for the echo. So they're actually seeing in sound by using their ears. And we've only recently have the ability to be able to record these calls and be able to actually now, as I said, most of the time it's a black object that's zipping around the sky, and it's very difficult to know, well, what is it? And the calls themselves have opened up a new arena. The cost of that equipment or those types of technology have definitely become a little bit more affordable. They also allow us to build up trends of what is actually happening. The visual side of it is, at the moment, I'm involved in definitely using still flash photography, where we get the bats to fly across a beam that triggers the flashes, and the flashes freeze that bat in natural flight. And just those images themselves are opening up a whole different realm. As I said, the bats themselves are known, they fall within the mammals in the order Chiroptera. And Chiroptera basically means hand wing. And that wing of a bat is that dexterity that we can do with our fingers. Our arms, you can bring your one arm out. They can manipulate their fingers and with the membranes. And what they can do and flip and from a flight perspective is amazing. And to actually now capture this, it is a freeze frame as they're flying across, where they're doing a halfway through a flip because they've actually closed the one wing and the one wing's open. And to be able to film that
is impossible. What is the speed? Is anyway, because they must be moves. You always see them. It's hard to share the bat experience when you're out.
It's how do you even put them into a flight cage? I mean, a lot of people bring them into cages and they try and fly the bats around. Natural flight versus a tented flight ability. Those bats are moving 20, 30 kilometers an hour. And also it depends on what their purpose is. Are they moving from one site to get to a foraging site? So they wanting to get to where they, I guess it would be their breakfast, starting in the evening. And yeah, some bats definitely do fly. They're flying to some specific spot, whilst others might take it a bit slower in that they are able to munch along the way. We have very little understanding of how far are they actually really flying in a night, what their social structures are. Within the bats, we talk about it. In South America, there are three vampire bat species, so they do eat blood. But saying that is there's Galapagos finches that are also vampires. They've evolved the ability to lick blood. The Maasai Mara, they take the blood from the cattle and they mix it up. It's a high source of protein, but without killing the actual cow. They're not slaughtering the cow, but they're drinking that.
It's living with the blood.
It's a very interesting strategy. That is not just bats, but obviously vampires came through with the whole point. And a lot of work's been done in South America, I think, because of the vampire bats. But there's only three species and they're restricted to...
I've forgotten about the vampire. But the big thing is now also they are generating a lot. They're eating a lot and therefore there's a lot of what they're dropping all over. And you explaining that it's a big industry elsewhere, but in South Africa, maybe not.
Yes, I think if somebody had to say, well, what is the economics? Recently, I've been in Zanzibar talking to some people that are within government, and all I could see the bats is, what is the tourist potential? And it's like, well, actually, forget about the tourism part of it. Are you aware of the economic services, the provisioning services? A bat that is 8 grams or even 2-3 grams, these bats are eating at least their body mass per night. And sometimes it's 3 or 4 bouts of they go out, feed themselves up, the iguana coming through. The amount of insects that they are eating, and I might need a time out in a calculator to actually work it out. But we see one bat, and if it's 8 grams, and they eat 8 grams of insects, 8 grams of insects would then, in a year, they're eating about 1.4 kilograms of insects per year. I have to do my maths again, but calculator. But you've got a population of over 1,000 and something at just one site.
You've got 1.4 tons of...
So it's 1.4 tons of insects. Most of the research, from a research perspective, is around agricultural pests. And to be honest, bats are not being selective. They're not going to go out and say, oh, I'm actually looking for that. They are feeding on insects in huge biomass. And as with the US agriculture suddenly realizing and putting that type of money into because of a disease, what is happening with just general household food security? We've got the global sustainability goals. They're looking at food, you know, zero hunger as a point. Well, actually, let's get rid of all the bats and let's see how that target's going to work. Because zero hunger, forget about commercial agriculture, just more people relying on other forms of it. The provisioning of other services is the guano, because the insects that they're obviously eating, they're eating obviously plants. It's a whole nutrient cycle. And bats have very, very rich guano. The guano is coming through. And as I said, I was actually quite surprised in Zanzibar, where one of the cave sites, which has a mosque built next to it, and they actually protect that cave. And that cave is where they're actually harvesting. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go into the cave. And it's not like a mining operation. I could not see where they've taken the guano. And the soil in that part of Zanzibar is, I don't know how the people survive, to be honest. And it makes sense that, yes, they are protecting that resource because they need to take that guano and they put it into the actual soil. But we're talking about a few centimeters of soil that's around with all this reef rock that is actually in the area. And these people are living out an existence by actually protecting the...
They're able to grow in that couple of centimetres of soil because of the richness of the
guano. And it's a...
But did they, were they bringing other fertilisers in as well? Or
they can't afford it.
They're protecting, so...
And they've definitely linked the bats and that fertiliser and that community was actually protecting that resource. And in Thailand, for instance, there's a monastery that actually harvests bat guano. It is a mining operation, but again, they also protect the bats in this cave and they supply to agriculture.
When does that begin to happen in South Africa, if ever?
There's a Dvert cave that has been for more than like 100 years being harvested for guano. Local farmers seem to have been utilizing that as a tourist. And a couple of years ago, I was at Arnhem Cave in Namibia, where the request had come from also a neighboring farmer, where they were carrying out sacks of this guano that he was, I think there was more of a gift exchange to a neighboring farmer. And Arnhem Cave is another large cave system. And there's a couple of almost a million bats that are definitely in there. So they're going off into the night, coming back. There's a lot of guano.
If it's not harvested, won't it block the cave?
It does, but also within the natural cave systems there's a whole bunch of other life. So cockroaches, other bacteria, and unfortunately cave sciences is something that is relatively new, or at least in South Africa, there's very, very few people that are looking into this. The bats themselves are bringing in guano for a whole wealth of life that is unknown to us, unknown to science. Within those caves, because it's definitely as we have the sun. Without our sun, we wouldn't have plants. Well, all life would actually become extinct. In a cave is dark. What is the actual transferring of energy? Bats are bringing energy from outside via guano into those cave systems. So that's some of the discussions is what is sustainable harvesting? I mean, from a conservation point of view is we... Specifically, as soon as money becomes involved in anything, we always have to put a bit of a question mark about, we need to give something back to nature. I think us as humans, we sometimes take and things must adapt or don't survive. You know, it's almost like a business model sometimes, you know, businesses must survive or not. But the point is that there is a balance. And as we are discovering within plants, the medical factors, what is potentially in these environments, and it's a potential, it might be absolutely nothing, but we are aware of medical research working on a lot of these new discoveries, what might be sitting in some of these actual cave systems that we don't know yet.
So is there any way of assessing how valuable the guano is in terms of fertilizing? If it's hyper-rich, you could reduce it by 99% with something and you'd have great fertilizer.
Yes. No, definitely. I think there's a lot more coming about that. I have definitely looked at it. It depends also what the bats may be feeding in certain areas and different regions and different places. Well, with the legalization of cannabis in the country, I know it was something that I walked past one of the stores and suddenly I saw bat guano for sale for quite a high price. I had to like turn around, come back and like reread this. But it seemed to have come from Madagascar, so they're importing it from Madagascar.
Back guano, really?
Back guano for the cannabis farming, for your cannabis plants. I have done a little bit of research myself where sometimes it is mixed with chicken manure as well, because there does seem to be different chemistries and what nutrients you may need for some of the systems. But it is extremely rich. I mean, it is from plants, it's going into the insects, it is 100% organic. We're talking about the numbers of bats, if you're talking about an urbanization, bats are also seen when they're in buildings. You do not want a leaky roof with a few hundred bats in your roof, so a couple of hundred bats that may be in your roof and they've been there for the last 10 years.
It might be collapsing.
You've got potentially, and you don't necessarily have the ecosystem as in a cave to actually process that guano and that, and then suddenly water comes in. And that's where a lot of people don't even know that they have bats in the roof of a house until they have a water problem, and you have this, unfortunately, this horrible guano now suddenly is leaking down. Your ceiling suddenly collapses.
Does it have a strong smell, the guano, or does it have any smell at all?
No, I wouldn't say so. I will admit, going into caves specifically, we do wear N95 masks. So the masks that are quite restrictive, because we have to be aware of within caves, the cavus disease histoplasmosis. And that's a fungus that grows in guano. Actually, in Durban, they actually have, I think, one of the highest rates of this cavus disease. Not that there's caves in Durban, but that's because of the high humidity in Durban and the ceilings. And bird guano.
So regarding bats and caves, I think one of the reasons that there's no great popularity or knowledge about bats is you don't see them unless you go into these dangerous potential cave hazards. So they're unlikely to be destroyed in this country, or could that happen?
Okay, I think the caves are easy because there's very few caves, and also depending on the structure of the caves, not every hole is suitable as well. And we're only looking at cave bats, which is about 20% of the bat species in South Africa.
Oh.
So the rest of the bats actually use trees, tree hollows, crevices. Some have specifically been adapted to live in cracks and crevices, and those are the bats that definitely are moving into houses. Bats, I think, have been very much associated with caves, but they actually are a very small percentage that actually use caves. I will admit I am biased towards caves because, as I'm saying, in the UK they can work on tree-dwelling bats because they have so few natural trees left. South Africa, we still have vast areas of the trees, and to try and track these small little bats that are, some of the tree-dwelling bats are like 3 grams. We just don't have the technology at this stage to put a radio tracker with, and then a solar panel on to recharge. Well, it doesn't work with a bat because they're not out during the daylight. And that's where I think it's actually very difficult to understand it. I have actually wondered about some of the trees, and going back to the guano, what is the relationship of the bat living in the tree? Or normally when they come out, they defecate. And what is that relationship between them actually fertilizing the natural landscape by utilizing the different trees? It's the tree-dwelling species, they're not in large numbers.
Right. But the thing is, it sounds like they're bulletproof bats, because but what could ever lead to the wipe out of a bat population in South Africa?
Well, it's like in America where a caver, bat researcher, we don't know, more than likely in the lovely pair of boots, was in a cave in Europe. They moved across. Generally, the sunlight will kill most things. And they went into a cave or mine and transferred this fungus. When did that occur? How long did it take before this fungus grew and then went onto the bats? And then the bats start moving and started to spread. And there's something that is definitely wiping
them
out.
But you're saying it's 20% of the population normally sits in caves. If you wipe out your 20%, you've still got 80%.
Caves are not equally distributed across the country as well. So there is some. We are working on the one species that does seem to migrate and has quite a large distribution. It actually was the same species that went from Cape Town into Europe all the way across to Australia until they decided, oops, these are all different species. So they have been divided up. And the breeding population for this species, the Natal long-fingered bat I'm talking about, they need caves to actually reproduce. Without caves, and specific caves under specific conditions, it seems, that's not any cave, they're not surviving. The vegetation dwelling or the crevice dwelling bats, again, those are bat species that are, as we are losing, or for instance, people are putting up lodges, houses, we are bringing in bat species that might not have existed before or had been in much lower numbers. So we are aware now in the grassland habitat, we're putting up a lot more buildings, and we're getting bats that in 1950s, I know there was a publication that talked about they found 12 of these bats together. That was the population size. We are now aware of the populations getting into the hundreds, because again, you've created this artificial structure that is supporting more. And now the question is more food being put into the system? And so the other species of bats are definitely at risk because of people's knowledge or trying to do the right thing. I think the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Oh, yeah.
Where we think we've got to do something as well. I think that's also something we as humans, we always sometimes have to interfere, and sometimes maybe just let nature
take
its course, because us intervening can potentially have more serious consequences. And it's hindsight looking back.
But just to add the experience recently in Venice, where you can't open your windows because they've destroyed the bat population, and now mosquitoes have totally taken over. So everybody's windows are shut, and now they've got to try and work out how to bring the bats back. Are you familiar with that situation?
The bat eating mosquitoes has been around for a long time. People have seen it as for malaria control.
Yeah, also, that's what I was thinking about.
The bat coming through. But something we have to understand is also you need to look at, not as a bat specialist, because I guess I'm trained as a nature conservator, so it's to look at everything in more of a holistic fashion. Bats love to eat stoneflies. Now, stoneflies or lacewings underneath houses or in the soil, sometimes you find these little upside down pyramid structures. If you drop an ant in it and the ant moves around, you'll see it. It's known as an antlion that eats them.
Really? I've never seen one.
I'm sure if we walked around the gardens around it, you will find it, specifically in undisturbed soils. And those then get into an adult phase. It almost looks like a dragonfly, but it's known as a lacewing. Those are ferocious predators for mosquitoes. So Mervyn Mansell, who I talked about with the histoplasmosis, that's his speciality group. I've literally caught bats in nets and tried to, they've got an insect in their mouth, and I've tried to get the insect out of the mouth to try and identify what they might be eating. Because we know they eat insects, but like what insects? And the number of lacewings that bats eat, because they're much bigger, there's a lot more energy in them. So the bats themselves are actually would love to eat all the lacewings. So the question is, there's I hate the word balance of nature, but the question that I would ask is, well, what's happened to that insect population? And specifically in Europe, and it is coming together, is the effects of light. Artificial light has now altered our environments, and we know that lights attract insects. So insects aren't naturally distributed around it, because now you've got a light source. And in Europe, they've started research much, much longer ago. They're realizing that insect populations are crashing, because a lot of times the insects are being drawn to a light. I think bats eating the insects, I think it's been an interesting idea for specifically talking about mosquitoes. And again, it's this idea of trying to use a specific species or a specific group. From a marketing point of view, it makes great sense to get funding and say, well, this is going to be the answer. But is it actually really the correct answer? Should we not be looking at the insect hierarchy as
why
well?
Why did they obliterate bats in the first place? In that particular, maybe they suffered as, you know, the possibility that bats might just disappear. But I think it's been so great speaking to you, because it's very much it's about nature conservation.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what we're, as an activity here, trying to explain how everything integrates. So even though our speciality is visual arts, we're about communications. And the smarter people are in terms of understanding where things come from and why they need to exist, the more important is what we're trying to say. And I think this conversation with you has been fantastic, but I think we can maybe take it to another level again, because how do we make nature conservation firstly understood as a concept, because it can be done in your own backyard. Let's talk more about it in due course. But thanks for the time.
No, thank you, David. And it's great, Scott, to see the environment as a whole, not, as I say, with bats, even ourselves, we're realizing that we need to actually understand the systems. If you do have a breakdown one way, there's a cascading effect that is going to occur.
And I suppose just in signing, we're really lucky living, I think, in Southern Africa, which most likely is so nature rich.
Oh, yes.
It's a paradise. You know, you feel sad for people leaving this country, because where are they ever going to come across this composite sort of complex of everything that we have? I mean, we say other than snow or skiing, this place has got just about everything else. Thanks very much, Ernest.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.